Accession number 17581, Reel 1.
Mr. White, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
I was born in Portsmouth.
Which year was this?
1916.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Portsmouth?
In Portsmouth, yes. At Fratton Board School, which do not exist anymore. It's gone.
How old were you when you left the school?
14.
Did you get a job?
Errand boy for groceries.
So what job were you doing when war was declared?
War was declared, I was an apprentice, bookbinding.
In Portsmouth?
Yes, in Portsmouth. Do you want to know who it was for?
Okay.
Cosby and Co.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain's broadcast?
Yes. Yes, I wasn't called up then, in September. Yes, I heard that. And I was down in Constitution Square, where I used to live then.
How did you feel when you heard that announcement?
Well, I don't know, actually. I was building an air raid shelter at the time for my family. And I knew we were going to get called up sooner or later. I didn't volunteer. And, yes, it's a lovely sunny day. I can remember it now on a Sunday. And there was an air raid warning soon afterwards in Portsmouth. Nothing came along, but I was testing the air raid shelter, I think, the alarms. And that's all I knew. And I went back to work again until March. We were conscripted in March 1940.
Why did you decide not to volunteer?
Well, I knew that I was going to get caught up anyway. And my ambition was to be an advertising artist. God, I used to draw a lot. That's what I wanted to do, and I wanted to carry on. Where I worked at Hanley's, the big store in Portsmouth at the time, and they had their own department drawing their own window dressing material, and the man in charge said, when you come out the army, there's a job for you here, because I was pretty good at drawing, you see, because that all went by the board. Hanley's closed up with all the bombing in Portsmouth, and didn't materialise. So when I came out of the army, I was confronted by my lads in the printing works and asked me to go back again. And that's what I done. I went back to printing works again, bookbinding.
So once you were called up in March 1940, what happened to you then?
We went to Isle of Wight, Parkhurst, outside the prison. We were in huts. We was there for about 2 weeks. And all we done there was learn and salute for our pay to get our beds all arranged for an inspection by the officers, which used to happen in the army, and rather than disturb it, we just sleep on the floor, so leave the bed as it was when they come in inspection the next day. And we fired a rifle once, then one or two route marches, and that was it. In 2 weeks, we had embarkation leave in 2 weeks.
How were you treated during those 2 weeks?
Very good, very good. We thought the iron was smashing then. Nothing wrong with it. You can imagine, from Sibley Street, everything was noisy. The sergeants were noisy at the time, and it's quite good. And we had embarkation leave, and we was in France within a month, wasn't we? About a month. We was in France before the Dunkirk business. And we got as far as Le Mans, the race course, and we'd done a bit of road running up and down there. Then we ended up at Marseille, under canvas. And by then, we were going through the Med to Palestine to join the battalion. They were in Palestine at the time. Of course, the Italians coming into the war. That closed the Med. So we're given 5 rounds of ammunition, put on a train, and brought the married families back to England again. And we got strafed on the way down once or twice. That's just before Dunkirk. And we got us back to England just before Dunkirk started, but a week before Ashmaden, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Before Dunkirk started. And we went up country to Cheshire, and then on to the golf course in Scotland, Troon. We were stationed there for a while, and we ended up at Aintree Racecourse, with 30,000 troops in the horse stables, in the stands. And from there, we were, well, Aquitania, the Queen Mary, and the Mauritania took 30,000 troops out to the Middle East. But we had to go all round the Cape, out in the Atlantic, to avoid the submarines and aircraft. And we ended up, we visited South Africa on the way, Simonstown, then to Ceylon, and ended up in Bombay. And up till then, it was wonderful, wonderful liners waiting on board the RAF. We thought the army was wonderful. We got to Bombay, we transferred to an Indian troop ship. And then, oh, it was terrible. We had cock coaches falling from the balcony onto our meal tables. They were run by Lascars. And when you're on board ship, you do guards in the passageways, the troops do. And we was outside the cookhouse. And we see these Lascars wiping the sweat from their arms and cutting our meat up. And there was nearly a riot on board.
Wiping the sweat with what?
A knife. We cut our meat up. They were sweating. It was very hot. They'd done this and started cutting our meat up.
Why did they wipe the knife on their arm?
I don't know. It wiped your sweat away, I'll take it. Anyway, we didn't like that. And eventually, they were turfed out the cookies and took over by the army. Well, then it wasn't so bad. Then. And we ended up in Muasca, which the battalion moved from Palestine to Egypt, to Muasca. And it was there that I would like to photograph of us, because all the KD we had never fitted us. We wore pith helmets, and the battalion was on parade, all smart. You imagine they're a regular battalion, and we marched on parade. We must have looked a real shower. We started sloping arms, knocked our helmets off. That's the first impression we got of the battalion. All the stones were whitewashed. Everything was pucker. Anyway, we soon settled down, and eventually we ended up with the Wavell's 20,000 at, oh, God, isn't that silly?
Sidi Barani?
No.
In the Western Desert?
We were, eventually. I'm trying to think where we went to.
Are you talking about the Canal Zone?
The Canal Zone. Oh, and it's dark. I can't ask him. He knows
somewhere
where it is.
Somewhere in the Canal Zone, anyway. Doesn't matter.
Mers Matru. There was there Mers Matru. And from there, we advanced into the desert. What is it? The Italians used to high-level bombing on us every day, but it's 30,000 feet up. And we only had three aircraft. That's a Faith Open charity. You've probably heard about that. Well, then the hurricanes arrived, and then the daytime raids stopped because they didn't like these hurricanes of ours. Anyway, eventually, before that, I was playing cricket for the battalion, and I got a cut over the eye, my right eye. And when I was in the desert, a septic rash took over my body, and I was sent back to Alex in hospital. When I came into hospital in Alex, I didn't go back to the battalion. We were sent with several other Hampshires to Mardi, a prisoner of war camp, high-ranking Italian prisoners. We were guarding that for a few months until a battalion come back out the desert. Then we rejoined them to learn we were going to Malta, to join a garrison at Malta. And we went from to Malta on the Ajax, the cruiser, uneventful, the journey, till we landed. We landed in air raid.
Just before you go any further, how much fighting did you do against the Italians with Wavell's 20,000?
In a desert, not a lot, not really. Not the battalion, not the time.
Why was that?
Well, because our carriers went up there to help them, the brain carriers, but we were just in defences. Dug in, waiting for the artillery. There was a gap there, and we were told the Italians were going to come through that gap in the desert. They never did. And eventually, we brought back 34,000 prisoners, not into Hampshire, but Wavell's men. We were part of them. We brought back 34,000 prisoners.
Can you describe what the Italian prisoners were like?
A shower, to be honest. The officers, when we captured them, they were in pyjamas. In the 620s, in the war 620s, we had their scent and face aftershave, all things like that. And with us, raggled crane, living in 620s all our life in the desert. But their heart wasn't in it at all. It was no trouble ever with the Artars.
Did they say anything to you?
Just glad to get it all over, I think. As meek as anything. No trouble with them at all. We had, but every couple of thousand Italians, there was one British soldier bringing them back. If it had been with the Italians, it had been over by Christmas. No doubt about that, the war. But then rum will come to the desert. That's a different story.
That comes a bit later,
yeah,
I think.
But by then, we're going to Malta. And we were part of the 8th Army in Malta, even then. Because we sink all Rommel's arms and ammunition going to his army in the desert, our planes in Malta. And our job on Malta was to guard the airstrips and the airdrums. And unload the ships when they come into Malta, which was very rare. We had a job unloading them in the harbours. And in fact, but Harbert had an older record of the unloading of a ship than anybody else when it was in Malta. But on the Sappy Strip, where these planes were, dispersal areas, we used to build the air raid shelters for them, cans, petrol cans filled with stones to save the shrapnel. But when the raids come over, we had to fill the holes in. That was our job. We had no shelter. We just lay flat on the floor till the raid was over, jump up and fill the holes in, for ready for the planes to come in again.
How did you like doing this job?
We didn't like it, but we had to do it. That's it. And also, we used to do patrols, night, dusk and dawn. And we had 30 miles of mortar to guard, our battalion. And we did dust patrols and dawn patrols every day. And when the siege was lifted...
What happened on the patrols?
Well, just go up these paths and make sure there's no... We were frightened of paratroopers to see. That's what we were waiting for. We thought we were going to get invaded any day, but it never come. We don't know why, but it never did.
How did you get on with the Maltese?
Very well indeed, because our rations were exactly the same with the Maltese population as us. We've done exactly the same. And in fact, I can say that I think we're the fittest battalion then and ever we were. We were half-starved, but we never stopped training. And when the siege was lifted, I show you what we'd done. We had a 27-mile mob march.
27 mile what?
Mob march. That's running and walking with all your weapons. On the 25th mile, Lord Gort took the salute. We marched past him for our Christmas dinner. It was the first time we had a pudding, which was we couldn't eat it because our stomachs had shrunken and our lads couldn't eat it. That's what we'd done when the siege was lifted.
You said you had the same rations as the Maltese.
Yes, exactly.
But what can you... Give me a typical day's food in Malta.
A tin of corned beef. Only tin of corned beef was 37 men's rations, which is impossible. So the cooks used to wait till the next lot come in and make one meal of it. We had no bread at the finish. We was on hard tack biscuits. We used to soak it in our tea with a chocolate to fill our stomachs up, which did for a while, but not for long. And the Maltese was the same. On exactly the same rations. We hardly got any vegetables, because nothing was coming through, convoys. Submarines would bring it. What food we did get was by submarine. That's all we could get in.
So what was your state of health like?
Very good. That's why I always say to people, we eat far more than we really need today. We've never been so fit in all our life we were then. We never stopped training. Every day was like whipcord. I must say this. I think we would be the fittest battalion in the British Army at that time. Not only us, our brigade, Devons and Dorsets, everybody on there. We never stopped work. Mob marches before breakfast, 5-mile route march.
But did the troops become obsessed with food?
Not really. You just got used to not having it. And, you know, to think about it now, it seems impossible, but... You did. You just didn't have it, so you didn't worry about it. We had other things to worry about with all the raids and things, so food didn't come into it, really.
What did you drink?
We had tea. We used to soak this army chocolate. It's like a cocoa in a bar. We used to soak that in our tea with these hard biscuits to make something substantial to eat. And that's all we had. And water, of course.
Were the Maltese growing anything, or did the troops grow anything?
Well, there's not much earth in Malta, really. It's not like this country. It's only a little layer of earth on the rock. And they used to grow the vegetables and things, of course, but to feed an army and a nation as well, it was impossible. Hardly anything at all. We had tin stuff. McConaughey's. McConaughey's soup. That's a byword in the army, McConaughey's. Everybody used to laugh at that. That was terrible stuff. But you had to eat it. You eat anything.
Did any bombs fall near you personally?
Quite a few on Saffy Strip.
Where?
On Saffy Strip. As a strip was made, there was two. One was a force one, which put planes there. It wasn't important for them to bomb. It didn't do any harm. The others were all the planes dispersed. It was away from the towns. We made these strips. The Hampshires made these strips themselves. Cut them out of the ground. They dispersed the planes.
How do you spell savvy?
S-A-F-I. Strip. And how far aerodrome was a little farther on. We had to guard that. That's where the Swordfish planes used to go and bomb Italy and Rommel's convoys. They operated from there. And at how far was the fighter planes in Malta. And all those places we had to guard. Not only us, the Hampshires and the Dorset. That was our brigade. And we had 30 miles of Malta coast to guard every day, night and day.
Did you think that the enemy would invade?
Yes, we really did. We thought it was coming any day. We were waiting for it. In fact, one Sunday, there would be three Messerschmitts come over. When the raids were over, they flew around Malta, low down. You could see the pilots' faces. We had no ammunition. Both our guns' barrels were worn out. We had to save the ammunition for one raid per day, which was at dusk. They come and do what they like. And these six planes to come over and strafe everybody. Till one Sunday, the battalion along Saffy Strip dug in with the Bren guns for Akak and went for these six to come over. And we let fly. And never come back anymore. We got one down. And never come back anymore, those six planes.
Did your battalion have casualties in Malta?
Not many. I think we lost about 20. Killed. That's all. In Malta. That's the marvellous part about it. And the Devons, I think the Devons lost about 3 more than we did. Because we did slit trenches, which is very good. You get in one of those, a direct hit, unless you get a direct hit, you are safe in those slit trenches. It's all rock and mortar. So it was pretty solid. And our life was spent in them, in and out, slit trenches. And he knew our meal times, because there's a lot of 5th Column in Malta. Italians quite close to Italy, you see. Meal times, we lined up for our food. He'd come over as sure as anything for a raid, because they'd try to break our morale, you see. The bloke had to disperse, no food, all got cold. Tea times, just the same. And a real big raid at dusk and at dawn. That was their favourite times.
But I suppose it's pretty obvious when lunchtime and breakfast...
They knew, whatever we'd done, they knew. They knew where we were having our meals. And that didn't help people's morale for a start. He was trying to break it. But I must say, he never did.
Did you not get low morale?
No. I'm very proud of our lads. No, never. They kept us going, training all the time. We weren't allowed to sit back and think and worry about it. That's a good thing, really.
Did you have contact with home?
No, never. Parcels, food parcels from home used to come about a year late. Cakes, all mildew. The chaps who opened a food parcel to share out with the lads, all the cake was mildew, no good. And letters, we got to get a letter once in 6 months, you were lucky. The convoy was getting sunk every time, you see, coming through there to Malta.
Do you remember any special ships coming in?
The OIO.
Ohio?
Ohio got blown in halves. And they got half the ship in the harbour and saved some of the things on board, the petrol and stuff. That was the main thing. We were all on bicycles, by the way. There was no cars and no petrol. We were riding our patrols on bicycles Everybody, troops in Maud, had a cycle with your brain gun and your rifle attached to it. And that's what we done. And when the siege was lifted, that's where my friend comes in, as where I first met him. I didn't know him up till then.
Is this Mr. Holmes?
Mr. Holmes. And the Maltese government asked the Hampshires to paint a cat badge on the guard room of Valletta Palace, the main guard, which him and I had done, about 2 foot square. And it's there to this day. He wrote to the Maltese government, they photographed it about on the 50th anniversary of Malta. They sent us one, which you see on the front room in there. And we're the only regiment that had that done on the wall. And on the wall there was 1,500 paintings on there, all fading away. Regiments have been there, going back to 1,500 on this wall. And there's our one there. And the colour is still there to this day as we've done it, except the silver background, that's all gone away.
Did any of the Hampshires, any of your comrades marry Maltese?
Yes, one or two of them did. And I don't know where they got on, of course, but one or two did, stayed in Malta. There's another one I know went to Australia, emigrated there with his family. There's one or two of them.
Did you have to get regimental permission to marry?
Oh, yes, yeah, yeah.
Would that have been easy to get?
Well, I don't know. I never tried it myself. One or two of them did. They got it and married Maltese.
Did you make any Maltese friends?
In that book there, did you find a Simon as a party? He's now a naturalised American. I was very friendly with him. And he's written to me since he's been to America. Got married out there. That's all.
We should say this is a book you're donating to the museum library of drawings of comrades.
Yes. A B company. My company at the time. That's all. Not the other company. It's just B company. It was stationed in the Safi Strip, I was telling you.
How did you make friends with this Maltese man?
Well, we was in Sirik School. The Maltese ARP was stationed there, the same place that we were. And we got friendly with them there. That's all the Maltese you see in that book I've given you. And Simon has a party with one of them. But since the siege's all over, he's gone to America, immigrated there, and he's married to an American woman.
Was the siege period a miserable time or a pleasant time for you?
Well, no, it wasn't. I wouldn't say it's pleasant, but we should make our own entertainment, have our own concert party when we could, when the raids were finished or slowed down, things like that. And we had cricket matches with other regiments when the bombing was over, and football. All things. We never stopped doing things like that.
Did any of the troops get into trouble?
Well, yes, but this Maltese ambeats, they call it, the wine. They used to drink it like they thought back in England, drinking a pint of beer. And some of them goes, probably stupid. In the hospital at Hamroon, there's a lot of them went there. Some were going blind with this ambeat.
Was it sold on a proper basis? Or
In little cafes, I don't know. They tell me that was made of the very poor grapes at that time, during wartime. And our people, they used to try to drink it. They'd think they're in a pub with a pint of beer. The Maltese have a glass of this stuff. They last it all evening. That's the trouble with them. But there's only a few like that. But
what's this wine called?
We used to call it ambeet. Well, I don't know what they had a special name for. I don't know. I don't drink myself, so I wouldn't know. But the name for it was ambeet, they used to call it there.
So once the siege was lifted, what happened to you and the battalion then?
When the siege was lifted, we reorganised, of course, and had people come out to us to join the battalion. And that's where my platoon was formed, the anti-tank platoon. Before that, I was in B Company, in a rifle company. And they decided every regiment should have an anti-tank platoon, so they'd right with them. before we used to rely on the Royal Artillery anti-tank regiments, but they're too far away. So they wanted the anti-tank guns to be with the troops right there with them. And that's what we've done. We had six pane of anti-tank guns in three sections. And we used to go with the rifle company as protection against tanks. And more or less as a morale lifter, really. Because the infantry, they weren't frightened of the man. It was the tanks. You felt so hopeless. But when they had new less anti-tank guns with them, they could deal with them, they felt a lot better.
So what weapons did the anti-tank platoon have?
Six-pane anti-tank guns. We had a carrier, which I've got a model in there, with a gun on the back, six-pane anti-tank gun. We had our brain guns, our own sidearms, of course, and everything, Mills grenades, everything on board. But our main weapon was the anti-tank gun. And we had armour-piercing shells and high-explosive shells as well. We could deal with peel boxes.
And so you were allocated to the anti-tank platoon?
Yes. It was formed in Mortar in 43. Before then, we didn't have one. And when we invaded Sicily, we had two painters, anti-tank guns, which were pretty useless, really. Then they gave us six painter guns, which were quite effective. More so, in Mortar, the new ammunition came out, which they called Zebo. It was a new armour-piercing shell, which would pierce the tank itself and fly in inside the shell with the crew inside. When we had those, we were a lot more confident. We knew we could deal with them. But some of their tanks, the old anti-tank shell, just didn't penetrate. It hit them, and that's all. But this Zebo used to go penetrate right through the tank itself, and the head go right inside amongst the crew.
How do you spell Zebo?
Z-A-B-O, I think that's how it was. Z-A-B-O. I think that stood for something. I wouldn't know what it was. It was on a secret list at the time they gave it to us. It was a special force inside the shell, and the shell itself, the plastic, used to fly off and fly away. And if you got the speed then, which is pretty fast, 4,000 feet a second, it used to go, this stuff. So imagine how powerful it was. And hit the tank and penetrate inside. Which is very effective.
How many of these six-pounders would the platoon have?
We had six. And as the companies went forward into attack, we had two guns with them. We had three sections of two guns with different companies. And I used to go with my B company most of the time. Two six-pounder guns. When there was no tanks to eat, we're just infantry, like anybody else. We had our brain gun, our sidearms and everything.
But what was your job with the anti-tank platoon?
Look after tanks. That was in...
No, your own personal job.
I was in charge of the carrier and the six-pounder gun. We had a sergeant on every gun with the five crew, including the driver. And we lived on that. That was our home. We had a big tarpaulin. He said, fly over the top and sleep underneath it in France. And that was our job.
So you were responsible for the proper functioning of the gun?
And yeah. Six-pounder. And I know we accounted for five, which, I mean, you didn't have tanks all the time, but it was that noise. When infantry was dug in, you heard those tracks moving ahead of you, and that's what they didn't like. Naturally, they didn't like it. You had nothing to fight against. Rifles no good. That's why they brought out the anti-tank gun for the actual battalion, not rely on the Royal Artillery. We had our own guns with us. And infantry, we were with them all.